Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Nervous residents in the U.S. state of Hawaii received a message early Saturday that made the threat of a possible missile strike very real after a huge mistake was made. Hawaii Governor David Ige says a false missile alert was totally unacceptable, and he said the warning was caused by human error. The Administration of Hawaii's Emergency Management, or Administrator, Vern Miyagi, told reporters that the person responsible for the erroneous message feels terrible. However,
the consequence of this is obviously bad. I'm working on credibility now because we've worked so hard to get this in place. That's why I want to tell the public right now is, again, this was a mistake on our part. But don't let that stop as far as the preparation and the warning time if this happens for real.
Questioned repeatedly by reporters about how such a mistake could happen, Governor Ige said his administration is doing everything possible to make sure it does not happen again. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte says he is not interested in extending his six-year term or canceling elections next year. During an interview with news website Minda News, he said there will be no suspension of elections and there will be no term extension, especially for me. The president talked about his vision for a Philippine federal government. He said he envisions a structure along the lines of the French government. Tunisia plans to increase aid for poor families by $70.3 million after nearly a week of protest over austerity measures. Several hundred protesters took to the streets Saturday, where the 2011 uprising first began. On Friday, protesters in cities and towns across the country waved yellow cards, a warning sign to the government, and brandish loaves of bread, a symbol of day-to-day struggles. This is VOA News. A survey by three leading agencies, that's the UN Refugee Agency, UN Children's Fund, and the UN's World Food Program, finds more than three-quarters of the more than 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon are now living below the poverty line. We get more from Lisa Schlein.
It says almost 9 out of every 10 refugees end up in debt. UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler says that makes refugees vulnerable.
Obtaining legal residency continues to be a challenge, leaving refugees exposed to an increased risk of arrest, hindering their ability to register their marriages and making it more difficult for them to find daily labor, send their children to school, or access health care.
Spindler tells VOA the precarious situation facing Syrian refugees is pushing them into adopting negative coping mechanisms such as early marriage and child labor.
Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. An Iranian oil tanker that had been burning off the coast of China for more than a week exploded into a mass of flame Sunday and then sank. There was no hope of recovering the bodies of the crew members, according to Mohammad Rastand, a spokesman for the Iranian rescue team. Rescue workers had recovered the bodies of three crew members from the Sanchi, the oil tanker that collided last week in the East China Sea with the CF Crystal, a Chinese cargo ship. A body found earlier last week is believed to be another of the 32 crew members, which included 30 Iranians and two Bangladeshis. As of Saturday, U.S. officials confirm resuming requests for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services announcement comes after a judge last week temporarily blocked President Donald Trump's decision to end the program later in the year. The statement said that people who were previously granted deferred action under DACA may request a renewal. However, the agency is not accepting requests from individuals who were never granted deferred action under DACA. Pakistan has denounced as irresponsible remarks by rival India's army chief in which he vowed to expose Pakistan's nuclear bogey. This is in the event of a war between the two rivals. Pakistan and India have fought three wars since gaining independence from Britain in 1947. The two countries have since equipped their armies with nuclear weapons. And again, nervous residents in the U.S. state of Hawaii still reeling after a message early Saturday made the threat of a possible missile strike very real. It was, in fact, a mistake, and the governor there says it was human error. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
One of the main reasons for which she has been expelled, according to executives of the party, is because of her failure to support the presidential bid of her vice president.
The Liberian ruling party expels President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from the group.
Fully is another descendant of Mwalimu that has also stood firmly and said no to this suggestion.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli rejects calls to amend the constitution to extend his rule.
We are going to go out to fail any of these moves by the regime through popular mobilization of our people.
And the Ugandan main opposition party launches a defiance campaign against President Yoweri Museveni's government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Liberian ruling Unity Party has expelled the country's outgoing president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, from the party. Officials of the party voted her out late Saturday. She was ousted because of her alleged decision not to support Vice President Joseph Boakai, the party's candidate in last year's presidential poll. Boakai, who served as Johnson Sirleaf's vice president for 12 years, lost the election to former soccer star Senator George Weah. For more about the story, I reached Leonard Dodu, the Front Page Africa newspaper news desk chief in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
She has been expelled from the ruling party, that is the Unity Party that brought her to power in 2005. And also 2011. One of the main reasons for which she has been expelled, according to executives of the party, is because of her failure to support the presidential bid of her vice president, who became the next standard bearer of the party. So they said that was in violation of the party's constitution and warrant suspension. And prior to that, many people had been calling for her expulsion from the party, but then they played it very low until quite recently, which was Saturday.
Do you think that the accusations by the officials of the ruling party are justified? Because obviously there appeared to be internal problems leading to the election. Why didn't they resolve this before the election?
I was speaking with one of the executives of the party on this very matter, and he told me that there were several interventions to solve some of these internal wranglings within the party. However, according to him, the sitting president was very adamant in, listening to people who tried to intervene immediately between she and the party, she and the vice president, and then she totally stayed away from his political campaign. She never showed up at the launch of the campaign. There was no day seen wearing any of the party's paraphernalia during the campaign. At no time did she ever campaign for her vice president. And he told me that there were several interventions, but then it could not work.
What is the purpose of her expulsion, and what do they want to achieve by this expulsion?
That was also one of the questions I posed to him. And he said that, well, the decision is already long overdue because the party's constitution says that it is the responsibility of each and every member to support the party's candidates to election. And her failure to do so warrants expulsion. What they hope to achieve, well, he couldn't tell me that, but he only said that they are only fulfilling the constitution, since the constitution warrants her suspension for violating certain aspects of it.
Some are suggesting in Liberia that this is a fallout because of the failure of Vice President Joseph Boakai to defeat Senator George Weah during the election runoff, and that is why his supporters within the ruling party are going against the outgoing president. Are these what you are hearing on the ground?
Yes, that is correct. I mean, it was heavily rumored and speculated that the outgoing president supported President-elect George Weah, I mean, financially, morally. It's widely speculated that she supported him as from his own party. So this is one of the main reasons for which the political party, the ruling party, is taking a decision against the president. Confirmed to me by the Assistant Secretary General for Press and Publicity, who I spoke to not long ago. He said they have all reasons to believe that the outgoing president supported financially and morally President-elect George Weah's campaign.
How are Liberians receiving this news Sunday?
Well, a lot of them are saying that a belated action, that this is an action that should have been taken long ago, especially during the political campaign, when it was very glaring that the president wasn't really giving much support to her own party, even though there is no concrete evidence to prove that she supported President-elect Weah. It was quite surprising that the opposition party that is now becoming a ruling party had a more elaborate campaign as compared to the outgoing ruling party. I mean, so many people believe that, well, she must be getting his finances in some way, and all fingers pointed to the president. So during the campaign, a lot of the members of the Unity Party kept calling for her expulsion. I mean, there were demonstrations before the party's headquarters on several occasions. They were all calmed down. So many people are saying that this decision is belated and it might have no impact any longer.
Leonard Dodu is the front page African newspaper news desk chief. He spoke with me from Monrovia. Tanzanian President John Magufuli says he will not seek to extend presidential terms, a move aimed to reject calls from his own party to prolong his rule. Humphrey Polepole, publicity secretary for the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi Party, or CCM, who issued the statement, said the president is not happy with the ongoing suggestion to extend his rule. The statement also said that a constitutional amendment will be against the party's rules and the Tanzanian constitution. For more, I reach Humphrey Polepole in the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
President Magufuli asked me to inform citizens and members of Chama cha Mapinduzi yesterday. It's very clear that we have a constitution that we honor so much, and the constitution is very clear on the term limit, two terms, each one having 5 years. And there's been discussions in the recent days that because Magufuli has done so much within 2 years of his presidency, that probably no any other president has tried to do so. Great developmental achievements have been recorded. So there were moves here and there that he should extend the term limits from 5 years to 10 years. And there has never been a meeting of Chama cha Mapinduzi that deliberated on this matter. It has never been part of our priority agendas.
Some Tanzanians we spoke with were suggesting that even Mwalimu Julius Nyerere, who led the country to independence, did not extend his term rule. So why will even people in the Chama cha Mapinduzi party, the CCM party, even bring such a suggestion that a president would ask Mr. Humphrey Polepole to come out to dismiss such a suggestion?
No. Even during Mwalimu era, there were attempts to convince him to continue, and he stood firmly and said no. So Magufuli is another descendant of Mwalimu that has also stood firmly and said no to this suggestion.
Mr. Polepole, has the party become power drunk because it's been in power since the country gained independence from Britain?
No. CCM respects, honors the constitution. Whatever that we've done has been done within the framework of the constitution and the laws of Tanzania. The surety we've received from Tanzanians has always been given to us constitutionally. The citizens have made their decision several times before the multi-party democracy and after when we started the multi-party democracy in Tanzania. The citizens of Tanzania, who after looking after deeply and clearly on how CCM has performed in bringing about development, they've given that honor to lead Tanzania. And that has happened purely within the framework of the Tanzanian constitution. There has never been a single time that CCM would want to take over leadership in Tanzania, not in the framework of the constitution. It is not our thing, it is not within our founding ideals, and it will never be, not in this leadership, and not in any leadership that would come from CCM in Tanzania.
Some are suggesting that the president appears to be cracking down on dissent and undermining the constitution by banning radio and newspapers, and that this is against the constitution the president swore to protect.
In Tanzania, which is one of the democratically led countries in Africa, probably one of the leading democracies in Africa, people have their freedoms, they enjoy their freedoms, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. The allegations that we are undermining rights of people is to be ignored. People here have their life every day. The only thing that we're saying is people should adhere to the constitution and the laws. If you do anything against the laws and the constitution, measures will be taken against you, and this happens everywhere, even in China.
There were reports that some students have been missing. The police came out and said that they are investigating. People are saying that the government has been slow to find these missing students. How do you respond to that?
I've never heard such stories. But one thing that I know is when people miss, there is a procedure, handled by the police force. And once it is clear and all the investigations are completed, the citizenry will be informed. So speculations while the investigations are ongoing is also against the law because you would interfere and influence the professional work of the police force.
Humphrey Polepole is the publicity secretary for the Tanzanian ruling party, CCM. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. The Ugandan main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has launched a new defiance campaign against President Yoweri Museveni's government. The FDC called on citizens to boycott companies run and owned by members of the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. The move, the opposition says, will help deliver its goals, among them to end President Yoweri Museveni's rule. The opposition's call came after President Museveni signed into law a constitutional amendment which removed age limit that would have prevented him from seeking additional terms. To learn more about the defiance campaign, I reached Patrick Oboy Amuriat, the leader of the main opposition FDC in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
This is in response to the decision of 317 members of parliament who decided to listen to the call of Mr. Museveni and go ahead with the amendment to the constitution that effectively endorsed Museveni for presidency for life. They also went out of their way to increase their term by 2 years. They contested on the basis of a 5-year term. And so we are saying, you know, we are going to go out to fail any of these moves by the regime through popular mobilization of our people. And this is really the meaning of the new campaign that we have started. And we are beginning with members of parliament. We are going to urge the population to isolate these members of parliament.
How feasible is this new strategy of positive defiance to boycott businesses of everybody who is connected to the government? And how responsive do you think your supporters will be to help with this campaign? Because obviously, it's a huge task.
We believe that the anger of the people in Uganda has reached tipping point. Because if you listen to the ordinary Ugandan, he is going to tell you that he disapproves of what members of parliament did. The survey indicated that 85% of the people said they were not in favor of the amendments. And everybody who matters here, really, with the exception of Mr. Museveni and his MPs, have spoken out against the amendment. When you talk about religious leaders, you know, across the religious divide, we have statements made by them under the Interreligious Council of Uganda. They did not support what Mr. Museveni and the 317 MPs did. And so, really, we have got a population that is unanimous on this.
How long do you plan to sustain this defiance campaign? And do you anticipate any backlash from the government? Because this is a bread and butter issue.
It's really not possible. We can't put our finger to a particular time when this is going to crystallize. It largely depends on how responsive the population is and, you know, what the regime is going to do in response to this. It's clear that, you know, the regime is not just going to sit back and take us unaware.
Are other opposition and civil society groups in support of this initiative?
Yes, indeed. Actually, we have seen the members of the Democratic Party, members of the Justice Forum and the Truth and Justice Forum. We have also seen members of civil society coming up against what has happened in my country and definitely in support of what we have announced and in support of any other action that could bring pressure to bear on the regime in Kampala. And the situation is really not being helped by the nature of our economy at the moment, the way the economy is doing. We have got a situation where our economy is actually limping and matters could get worse in the country.
What is the ultimate objective here? Is the ultimate objective to get rid of President Museveni through people power, as some of your supporters have been saying?
The objective is basically to give back power to the people and let the voices of the people be heard by those who are in power or who are in leadership, and make all the decisions that are taken in this country people-centered. If this means, you know, getting Mr. Museveni out of power, so let it be. What is most important for us is to give back power to the people. And this has to be earned by the people themselves. And so then once the people have got a say, you know, the people of Uganda themselves will come together in a transitional power-sharing arrangement. And this is what we envisage.
Patrick Oboy Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, the FDC. He spoke with me from Kampala. Now moving to Cameroon, the Maiduguri-Mora corridor has been fully reopened after being closed due to the Boko Haram conflict. Cross-border business is slowly picking up. However, soldiers from the multinational joint task force remain posted to secure travelers. commuters are cautiously optimistic. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka accompanied the Cameroonian military to some parts of the road and has this report from northern Cameroon.
Music blasts here in the northern Cameroon border town of Amchide from loudspeakers in a bus that is just arriving from Maiduguri, the capital and the largest city of Borno State in northeastern Nigeria. Didier Bumjol, a Cameroon soldier of the multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram terrorists, says it is the third bus transporting goods from Nigeria that has arrived this day, Saturday, January 13, 2018. He says he and his team of nine systematically conduct security checks on all of the buses.
You have to open the back boat and see what is in the back boat because they carry drugs, they carry anything that is forbidden by law.
Among those who have come to get supplies from the bus is Asta Durumsu, a Cameroonian who lost her husband when the terrorist attacked Amchide in 2014. She says she returned from Kolofata, some 10 kilometers away in Cameroon, when she was told that she could now get supplies from Maiduguri in Nigeria to sell in Cameroon. She says she is alone to take care of her two children and has to struggle for their survival by selling goods from Nigeria by the roadside. She says she makes an average of $4 a day, which is sufficient for her family. Maiduguri in Nigeria lies 130 kilometers from Amchide in Cameroon. The closure of the border 4 years ago led to a sharp fall in Cameroon food exports like sorghum, cotton, rice and onions to Nigeria, while basic commodities imported from Nigeria like fuel, textiles and electronics could not enter Cameroon. Nigerian Major General Rogers Nicholas says they fully reopened the border because Boko Haram atrocities have been drastically reduced.
What we are doing is to restore back economic activities, to reduce threats to lives and properties along that corridor. All hands must be on deck to see that this operation is successfully done. They should pass the information to the necessary military commanders on the field so that they can be able to quickly take decisive actions.
However, Cameroonian General Frederick Jonkep Mehomi says the military should be watchful as suicide bombings have continued. He says Cameroon alone recorded at least 60 suicide bomb attacks last year.
L'activité opérationnelle s'inscrit dans la stratégie régionale.
He says their operational strategy, as spelled out by the multinational joint task force, envisages the stabilization of areas that were previously under heavy attacks from Boko Haram. He says they have to make sure the Maiduguri corridor, passing through Bama, Banka, Amchide, right onto Mora in Cameroon, is completely reopened and fully functional to facilitate trade so that the population can finally return and settle in their localities. The insurgency has displaced more than 2 million people in Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, and has killed at least 25,000. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Amchide, Northern Cameroon.
The United Nations Human Rights Office says it is concerned about the large number of arrests as Tunisian authorities crack down on protesters demonstrating against price and tax hikes. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The protests, which began last weekend, reportedly are turning more violent, prompting a sharp rise in the number of arrests. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says nearly 800 people have been arrested since Monday, about 200 between the ages of 15 and 20.
We call on the authorities to ensure that people are not arrested in an arbitrary manner and that all those detained are treated with full respect for their due process rights and either charged or promptly released. The authorities must ensure that those exercising their rights to peaceful expression and assembly are not prevented from doing so.
Colville tells VOA that so far, his office has no reports that those arrested are being ill-treated.
But it's something we look out for because there have been reports in the recent past in other situations of ill-treatment of people in detention. So it's something we would look out for very closely. But at this point, we haven't had any specific reports.
Next Sunday is the anniversary of the 2011 revolution, which ushered in the so-called Arab Spring, a series of protest movements calling for reform in the Middle East and North Africa. The Tunisian protesters say none of the objectives of the revolt have been achieved. Concern is rising that events this weekend might get out of control. Colville says it is particularly important to ensure demonstrators are able to protest peacefully. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. The 2018 African Nations Championships, CHAN, kicked off in Morocco on Saturday. This is the fifth edition of the tournament that features only players plying their trade in their own domestic championships. The host Morocco are holders and record two-time champions, although they lost to Congo-Brazzaville in the qualifying matches. On Sunday, Guinea takes on Sudan, while Zambia take on Uganda, and Ivory Coast play Namibia. In another development, African champions Wydad Casablanca has sacked their coach, Hussein Amata, after a poor performance in the first half of the season. Amata was on the final shortlist for CAF Coach of the Year award. Now, moving on to athletics, organizers of the Boston Marathon have announced the final elite field for the IAAF Gold Label Road Race on April 16th. Between them, the elite field has won 14 global championships medals and 17 World Marathon Majors titles, six of which came from the Boston Marathon. Defending champions Geoffrey Kirui and Edna Kiplagat will face a strong domestic lineup that includes Olympic bronze medalists Galen Rupp and New York City Marathon champion Shalen Flanagan. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Solomon Dixisa and defending women's champion Burns Kitrui will lead an impressive field at the Mumbai Marathon, whose 15th edition is set for January 21st. With the announcement of the elite field, four men who have run under 2 hours and 7 minutes and another 5 men who have run under 2 hours and 9 minutes, as well as 6 women who have run faster than 2.29, will be on the starting line. Moving on to tennis, a six-time champion Novak Djokovic will head into next week's Australian Open, uncertain of how his elbow will react to the competition. This is so because he's been off for 6 months. The 30-year-old Serb has not played since resigning against Tomas Berdych in the quarterfinals of the Wimbledon in July 2017. Another player returning from injury is ninth seed and former champion Stan Wawrinka, who has not played since Wimbledon because of a knee injury. Finally, it's a big relief for football associations and clubs across Africa after Confederation of African Football, CAF's decision to take over all payments of match officials. Local football associations and clubs have previously carried the burden of paying referees' allowances, flights and accommodation for CAF matches, as well as club continental engagements. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
You're a good soldier, choosing your battles. pick yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front line, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's off, you feel it. This is Africa. Samina mina, eh eh. Waka waka, eh eh. Samina mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa. Listen to your dad. This is our motto. Your time to shine. Don't wait in line. For Africa. Samina mina, eh eh. Waka waka, eh eh. Samina mina, sakalewa. Anawa, ah ah. Samina mina, eh eh. Waka waka, eh eh. Samina mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm well on my journey, biggie biggie mama, one A to Z. My sister's on my journey, biggie biggie mama, from east to west. My team, waka waka, my
Promenade ya bolingo, sentiment yo yo,
eloko moko ndenge nzola amore eloko yo misika epesi monganga problème ebuki ba thermomètre eboyi nde toli ya bato e esengise morena azala pembeni bandeko e Miziki na kobeta ya mundana na polo kamba Mokolo na kozonga, rendezvous menonge Na kei California, mobembo ya mosala Susi morena, kotu esle musika Nzora amore, eloko yo misika Na kati ya Santa Barbara Na beli maladi ya tension Eboyi ba diagnostic Naleli morena ngola mosika o bandeko e
Godé Castello Mathieu Mavinga Binonde bato bokote la kangai soki ngindi Pele Mendel Uka balancement Ha ha Bana bato tranquille mama Pino mawate Parili kambo Uoka Boli nakaboye Sekate
Kobeta ya mundanda na polo kamba Mokolo na kozonga Rendezvous Luanda Na kei California Mobembo ya mosala Susi morena Kotu esle musika Nzola amore Eloko yo misika Na kati ya Santa Barbara Na beli maladi ya tension Eboyi badia
Your cup of tea, everything for you I go do. My mama, eh, your love I no go forget you. Mama, eh, now you fast, now you wash, oh, my infant head, oh. When I dey sleep, oh, for cradle bed, oh, everything for you I go do. Mama, eh.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is global outrage at vulgar comments reportedly made by President Donald J. Trump regarding African states and Haiti. Although the White House has denied elements of the statements, senators who were present at the meeting when the remarks were made confirm that indeed the president repeatedly made those vulgar comments. There is also the troubling comment that the vulgar remarks may resonate with the base of the president's party. Now, Africans must understand that even though one may have overestimated the notion of a post-racial society after the election of Barack Obama as president for two terms, there are indeed a large number of Americans who are quite decent and have not shown any racial animus towards Africans or people of color. But it is true that there is a diehard minority that feel this way. Africans must also bear in mind what some of our founding fathers like Nkrumah and Ezekwe told young Africans in the 1940s and early 50s. Go to the United States, young men and young women, because that is the land of opportunity. And even though today it may seem quite strange, but in the 1950s, America was a strongly anti-colonial and anti-imperialist state, and Africans were giving full encouragement to fight for their independence. The fact that things have changed should not dampen the enthusiasm of Africans who may want to come to the United States. Those who are opposed to emigration from developing countries, particularly Africa, forget that in the course of history, Europeans and many Americans over the centuries and decades sought fame and fortune in Africa. Indeed, the wealth of Europe and the United States would be inconceivable without the use of many of the riches of the African continent. But Africans must also bear in mind that this dependency syndrome has and continues to encourage the belief that Africans are asking too much of the largesse of the Western countries. Just a few weeks ago, over the issues of the Jerusalem vote in the General Assembly, President Trump and his ambassador said that many of these countries are ungrateful because they take the aid of the United States and behave badly by not voting with the United States in the General Assembly, forgetting what President Nyerere said in his last appearance in the General Assembly when he talked about the dignity of the African person. And my suggestion is that Africans should go back and read a very important book written in the 1950s by O. Manoni called Prospero and Caliban, which is a diagnosis and psychological diagnosis of colonialism. The dependence syndrome does prevent problems for Africa, and Africans should try to win themselves over from that syndrome. So as Africans join the world in its outrage against these vulgar comments about the African countries, let us hope that those in America of goodwill will be able to determine that the minority view does not represent the United States. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nine
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaq Kasali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our able engineer for today, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, parents give birth to the body of their children, but not always their characters. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of inexpensive, reliable energy delivery is one of the chief obstacles to growth and development in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 70% of people living in the region lack access to electricity, forcing them to spend significant amounts of their income on costly and unhealthy forms of energy, such as diesel fuel to run generators and kerosene for lanterns. But if there is one thing Africa is not lacking, it is sunshine, and that means a lot. Indeed, for some of the world's poorest people, it makes all the difference in the world. A little more than a year ago, Power Africa, a U.S. government initiative coordinated by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and Power Africa's partners, the United Kingdom Department for International Development, Shell Foundation, and the African Development Bank, launched the Scaling Off-Grid Energy Grand Challenge for Development, with a focus on pay-as-you-go solar home systems. The challenge's goal is to provide 20 million off-grid households in sub-Saharan Africa with clean, affordable electricity by 2030. So far, the challenge has made 40-plus investments in early-stage, off-grid energy companies, which are expected to result in some 4.8 million new electrical connections. One reason for the success of the startup companies that have won grants from the challenge is the fact that the cost of solar technology is falling fast, so it is within the means of those who live away from traditional power grids. And thanks to the new system of mobile money and pay-as-you-go financing, they can purchase the solar power generating equipment they need and pay for it in daily installments from their telephones for as little as 15 cents a day. Thanks to these technological and financial innovations, many people are getting electricity for the first time every day. In these newly electrified communities, business can flourish, clinics may safely store vaccines, and students may study long after dark. Indeed, access to clean and reliable electricity can enable entire communities to escape the cycle of extreme poverty. The Scaling Off-Grid Energy Grand Challenge for Development Partnership, solar technology, and companies that bring light and electricity to off-the-grid homes and businesses are revolutionizing daily life for millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.